Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. Although I don't live in the UK, I of course pledge my allegiance to the new dear leader, the new person that is going to bring about change on top of the change that was originally brought about by the other government whose policy was to bring about change. Hello, 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 and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. So cheers, everybody.
Yakida.
Taylor. Cheers, Lipton. Yep. Cheers, Paul Morland.
Lachaim, Scrubianan.
Cheers, Hergen, Gerligan, Capis, Salu, Saludo, Proust.
Nazrovia.
Turbisexy, yeah. Skoll.
Hey, Paul.
Hello.
We're doing the cheers at the moment.
You've not, it talks too much.
No, no,
you can stop talking now.
No, you don't interrupt this bit. Slander, and shut up, Lipton. Slander, you're starting already. You're already starting. For God's sake, right? Try and behave yourself in front of the guest, Lipton. Slander and Slanderbar, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are online public house. It's on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, which discuss based science and what's going on in the news from a sort of a slightly academic perspective, and discuss the kind of stuff which is increasingly expunged from our woke joke universities. And we have a very special guest for you today, and I interviewed him a few years ago, about 3 years ago I think it was, on the channel, and that is Dr. Paul Morland.
Good evening, Paul,
please introduce yourself.
Yes, well, I am Paul Morland. I am a demographer. I write and broadcast on matters of population and sometimes trespass a little beyond my saved territory. I've written a number of books on the subject, and I have a new one coming out in the autumn, but I'm sure we're not here to plug books.
No, we were not. But if we were here to plug books, we would plug No One Left, Why the World Needs More Children, Tomorrow's People, The Future of Humanity in 10, I got my own writing,
yeah, 10 numbers.
And Bust, The Economy of Population Decline. And
that's
the Human
the next
Tide.
One. You're forgetting The Human Tide, How Population Shaped the Modern World. And most importantly, and significantly of all, Demographic Engineering, Population Strategies in Ethnic Conflict.
Yes, that is a very interesting one. My research for the show, I discovered it, and it's very expensive.
Well, it's the one that's the academic book. So it's
the one published by Routledge, and it's, you know, ridiculous. All right, anyway, good. My book is also published by Routledge, one of them, and it's very expensive. Anyway, so cheers, Paul, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. And yes, indeed, to a number of RIPs, actually. RIP Kevin Keegan. I mean, he only took England to the qualifiers, but still. And RIP Jim Goad, who I will return to later. Right, but starting off then, so the thing I wanted to focus on before all this destruction of the British cabinet started a couple of hours ago was something that I found really rather fascinating, which was that we all know what happened, Anne Widdecombe, God rest her soul, and so forth, last week and the week before. And what's happened recently over the weekend is that Hope Not Hate, your favourite kind of policers of anti-woke, took down their Anne Widdecombe hit piece, essentially, from their website. And it's a hit piece that says that she's homophobic, that she has vile views, that she has all kinds of stuff. And, you know, it strikes me that some people have used the term stochastic terrorism with regard to Hope Not Hate. And I thought to myself, well, why would they take it down? Surely take it down because job's done. Job's done. She's out. She's gone. What was supposed to have happened has happened. Am I going too far, or is that a reasonable reaction to what they've done? What do you think, Paul M?
Well, I think it's a cynical reaction, which I very much sympathise. I think there are very appropriate times to be cynical. I'm sure that's not what they intended. It's very galling sometimes to suggest that those we dislike don't have quite such bad intentions as we assume. But I think there's a more sort of profound point, really, which is not that they really expected her to be assassinated, although they absolutely should take responsibility. And if the boot were on the other foot, if it had been imagine it had been a right-wing website denouncing someone on the left, you know, we would have heard nothing else. So I'm absolutely sympathetic with a cynical take on it. But I think what it actually brings to light, and I think you, Ed, know more about this than the rest of us, I assume, as a psychologist, is that sense on the left that we are the good guys. We're nice, we're sympathetic, we're empathetic, we're on the side of history, we're on the side of right, we're on the side of morality. And anyone who doesn't share our nice, lefty, cosmopolitan social, I mean, not one set of views, they vary somewhat, they're not a monolith, but anyone who doesn't basically share our outlook on the world is a nasty person. And we can be as nasty to them as we like because we're nice. And I think there's probably something profoundly psychological in that, which you know more about than the rest of us. But it's pretty universal, isn't it?
It is. I wouldn't call myself a psychologist because that's a protected word, but I'm a psychology researcher. But yeah, I think that that is generally the case. There's a lot of research that has found this, that they regard those that disagree with them as morally bad, as bad people. Whereas the conservatives tend to regard those that disagree with them as just misinformed, as just wrong.
Misguided, deeply misguided,
unreasonable.
Not inherently evil.
No, not inherently evil. But
the effect of what they do and what they believe is very often evil. But we don't think they're sitting there conniving. I mean, some of them are. I'm sure Stalin was, and Mao probably. But on the whole, we don't attribute moral evil to our opponents.
No, we disagree, and I think you in order to do that, you've got to have a certain degree of, mental stability, to not be paranoid about your opponents.
Could I quibble slightly on that? I actually think I do ascribe morality, but I think they suffer on the left from an excess of morality in the sense that, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and lots on the left don't realize when excessive morality and sanctimoniousness doesn't fit with the practicalities of politics.
So you're saying that some of them are actually highly moral, good people?
Well, no. This is where the whole virtue signaling thing comes in. Let's put it this way. They couch their arguments in excessively moral terms, so I agree on that. If only they were a bit more cynical and evil, that they may not actually gird themselves in this defensive posture of morality. If everyone just accepted politics is a mucky, dirty business, and no one's morally higher than anyone else unless you do something really bad. But Paul's right, it's this couching everything in. They're almost more moral than the Anglican Church now, which has lost its way completely.
Well, that's a very low bar.
Exactly. The Labour Party are actually the new, you know, they used to say the Conservative Party are the Church of England at prayer. Now it's the Labour Party, the Church of England, without a lot of the Church of England's left-wing politics.
My turn to speak. Unlike the rest of you, unlike the rest of you, I have a philosophy of power. I'm a libertarian, but libertarianism has a flaw. The flaw inherent in libertarianism is that libertarians do not have a philosophy of power. They construe power as negative, but one can use power, particularly the power of the state, to advance progressive agendas. And by progressive agendas, I am referring to policies that are favorable. So, for example, economic growth, innovation, not progressive in the American sense. The issue with the right is that the right is going to a seminar and leftists, they are preparing for warfare. And if your enemy is preparing for warfare and you're preparing for a debate, you're going to lose. And that's why we should retire some classical liberal philosophers. So, for example, F.A. Hayek, probably we should put down Hayek for a minute and take up somebody else. I won't say the name of the person we should take up. I won't. But we should put down Hayek for a minute and take up maybe somebody from Germany understands power.
Steady on, Lipson.
Lipton's broken his record for interrupting you, Ed, very early on, and now he's now he's broken his record for mentioning a very angry German man.
I don't agree with that though, because I think then he's like the left in many ways. Those people, they it's the same perception of your opponents as evil. You get that on the right as well, on the extreme right, that your opponents are evil and vile and terrible. It's the same kind of psychology. And in fact, that's what I found in that study that I did in the Scandinavian Journal of Psychology, that the mental illness politics correlation is kind of curvy linear, i.e. the far left are very mentally ill, the far right are mentally ill, they're just less mentally ill than the far left. So it's the same, this same neuroticism. If someone doesn't agree with me, then if you have negative feelings, then you become paranoid. They might kill me, they might hurt me, therefore I will see them as evil. Whereas people on the center right, they kind of, they're kind of content with the world, and they're high in a sense of agency, and they feel that they have power, even if they don't. Whereas these people on the left and the far left and the far right, they feel that they don't have power, even if they do. And so going back to Paul's point about psychology, it's complicated having two Pauls on the show.
Call me Troppo.
Yeah, I will do that. Okay. So going back to Paul's point about the psychology of this, then you have people who are basically unstable, that desire power, but they're fearful. And so they can't have a fair fight. And so the only way they can get power is by a sort of virtue signaling about outsiders and things like that. But you do get, I do think you do get the same thing on the extreme right, which is that you purity signal, you know, it's the Jew or whatever. So they're very similar.
Well, it makes me think of two people, actually, both what you and Lipton said. The first is, when Lipton was talking about negative freedom, negative liberty, Isaiah Berlin, who I once met, actually. I had a very interesting encounter with Isaiah Berlin about 30 years ago in Oxford, a few years before he died. I used to be able to do a very good impersonation of him, but I won't try it now. It's too long ago.
That's a niche demographic now, Paul.
Sorry?
That's a niche demographic you're appealing to.
Let me just try. No, there is no God.
No, he didn't speak at all like that.
And he wasn't Welsh. He wasn't Welsh.
Accent of someone who might have turned up in England as he did from Russia at the age of about 13. It wasn't quite a foreign accent, and it wasn't quite a British accent.
Anyway, I'm remembering it from a documentary 30 years ago. So
right, okay. Well,
all right, carry on.
We'll let the viewers judge between your Isaiah Berlin and mine. The other one, actually, talking of the far right, is Jonathan Bowden, because I read your book on him, and the reason I read your book on him, I've always been interested in people on the extreme. So when I was a kid in the 70s, and I think we're going to be talking about the 70s, I was a very devout Thatcherite, had high hopes for her coming to power, and many of those hopes were realised. But I've always been interested in the left. So I used to listen to Radio Tirana, which was like the most, you know, Radio Moscow was boring. Radio Tirana was real Marxism-Leninism. And in a similar way, I found Bowden, I think, very interesting. But I didn't get the sense from him, and maybe you wouldn't consider him as an extreme. I didn't get the sense from him that what motivated him, and I never met him, by the way, but I listened to everything he did at the New Right Forum, full of some disreputable people, I'm sure. But I listened to him, and I got the sense that what motivated him was ideas, actually. And if the division between a sort of what you call the far right and the center right, is being genuinely having a sense of agency and engagement with ideas rather than a resentment, a conspiracy theory, a sense of one's own moral rectitude and everyone else's evilness, then I would put him more surprisingly on the center right. He didn't come over to me as someone motivated essentially by animus.
No, I think you're probably right about that. I mean, I suppose I would say that I get the impression that there were different Bowdens. So there were different Bowdens for two reasons. One is that earlier in his life, he was simply a kind of far-right conservative, as it were, you know, along the
Monday lines. Club type.
Monday Club, Teddy Taylor or someone like that. But then he had I don't know if you call it a conversion, but a breakdown midlife. And then he reinvented himself, and then he wasn't involved with the conservatives anymore. Then it was with the far right. And in some speeches, he's reasonable, and he's as you say, interested in the ideas and analysing the ideas and whatever. And in other speeches, there's this, I think you do see this loathing of the opponents, you know, clear them out, you know, all this, you know, they're a disease. He literally used that word, right?
He did. So, he did sometimes get on his, he'd suddenly get into a rant, which I found his rants quite impressive, actually.
Oh, so did I. But and they're very inspiring. But the thing, I think looking back, like, I didn't even articulate this that clearly when I wrote the book, because I wasn't sure and I wanted to hedge my bets and whatever. I do think he was probably a kind of a male borderline, and so there were different kinds of self and the different. But yeah, I think he was interested. I mean, he looked in a very objective way at the ideas of the far left. And he didn't just dismiss them as just crap, you know. He engaged in it, you know, an intellect, even other things like so fascinating little recondite things like Punch and Judy and that sort of thing. So you do get that, but yeah, that's the fundamental difference. If you have a sense of agency, if you see that life is positive, if you see the world as positive, if you see yourself as empowered, that seems to be the conservative. Whereas the left in general, perhaps with the exception of sort of working class people that are left wing for economic reasons, and the far right, they see there's a conspiracy. We don't have power. We need to get power.
Yes. But all of this is sort of a bit, you know, it's an interesting discussion, but we mustn't lose sight of a simple fact, which is that an organization which has been so damaging is now at the heart of government, with no one seeming to think anyone has anything to answer for.
No, indeed. Mr. Matthew McGregor was the director of communications for Hope Not Hate, and he will be the director from 2018 to 2021, and he will be the director of political strategy for the Prime Minister, so the new Prime Minister. And this is a guy, I've looked into him, that he was responsible for a huge campaign calling conservatives Islamophobic and so forth. So he's kind of stirring up Islamic loathing against those people. He was responsible for a huge campaign against the Brexit Party, of which, of course, Anne Widdecombe was a member of the European Parliament. His organisation, 38 Degrees, demanded that Katie Hopkins and Tommy Robinson be thrown off Twitter. This is an anti-freedom person. So it makes me think that it's a bit like Blairism, that you have somebody who comes across as nice and pleasant and whatever, but doesn't really have any clear, the smiling face, as it were. But then behind him, you get very unpleasant people like Jack Straw or whatever, the ex-communists. And we've got the same thing again. We've got ex-communists behind this Everton supporting Liverpudlian that just talks about what, you know, just says vague things. It's quite dangerous, potentially.
Isn't there another blue nose in near proximity, Ed?
What's that?
I thought Paul was a Everton fan, no?
Me?
Oh, sorry, I misunderstood when we were off camera. I thought you introduced Paul to me as a blue nose as well.
Funnily enough, I have a brother-in-law from Southport, as a result of which I have four Everton-supporting nephews. So although I have no interest in sports at all, I keep enough knowledge of what's going on in football to know when to commiserate them, which is fairly frequently.
I just like the fact that in 1989, when I was collecting stickers for my Panini football sticker collection book, like you used to do in those days.
Album,
that's the word. My sticker album. Then the nickname for them was the Toffee Men, which Paul Giggio informs me is because there was a toffee factory that was in that part of Liverpool or something. But I just thought it was a lovely name for a football team, the Toffee Men. You know, great.
Yeah, there's a woman dresses up as an old-fashioned damsel and throws mint toffees into the crowd.
That's rather beautiful. Okay, Lipton, you're going to say something?
Yes. I was born in a developing country. So unlike Ed and Paul and Dr. Paul Moreland, I appreciate wealth creation. Classical liberalism is attractive because classical liberalism explains the progress and the part of getting wealth. That's what it does. It teaches us about progress, but it does not teach us how to destroy our enemy or how to pervade progress from being degraded. Classical liberalism can point out that illiberalism is bad, or free or anti-free speech policies are bad, or statism is bad, but it does not create a coherent worldview to explain how we reached the anti-statism in the first place. As I said before, and I will say again, we're fighting a war, a physical war. It's not an intellectual war. And if we don't learn how to get power, we're going to keep losing. For example, we don't have an equivalent of the Southern Poverty Law Center. We don't have an equivalent of the Anti-Defamation League. Paul said this a long time ago, and nobody continued the discourse. We should lace our enemies with law fear. The day was destroyed because of law fear. We are not appropriating the tactics of the left, and that's why we're losing and where we will continue to lose.
Yeah, but the problem is that it strikes me, Lipson, that if we were living in a right-wing kind of dictatorship, then I'd probably be left-wing and be in favour of the left. Like, I'm in favour of freedom. So I was reading this book yesterday called The Ruler of Catholic Ireland. It's by a guy called John McQuaid, who was the Archbishop of Dublin, and he was responsible for drafting their constitution and whatever. Like, up until the 1960s, pretty much every interesting book you could think of was illegal in the Republic of Ireland, including books by James Joyce. All of James Joyce's books, like their national writer, James Joyce.
By the way, just to contribute to this, the judge in 1933, there was an obscenity trial in New York to try and get Ulysses published, and I think it was the same day as Prohibition was repealed. It was a Judge Woolsey, I think he was called. And you should read, it's online, his judgment. He was just a district judge in southern New York County, I think it was. And his judgment is absolutely exceptional in terms of it's pro-free speech, but he also gives an assessment of the literary value of the book. And there's a wonderful little line he uses. He says, some people say that there's too much sex involved in this book, but you have to remember it's set in springtime amongst Celtic people. But it's honestly, it's only about 5 pages, I guess, not even that. And it is, I don't think most British writers could write that well, never mind a bog standard judge.
No, I agree with you. It's really worth reading, of course, that book. And it was banned, and everything by him was banned. I mean, it's incredible to think how repressive Ireland was until the sort of 70s. Incredibly repressive society, where they would prosecute booksellers for selling these books, where they would have people at the ports coming from Liverpool to check if you're bringing in banned books. Like Orwell was banned. It was extraordinary what it was like.
Well, this actually reminds me, you'll think I'm a name dropper. I mentioned Bowden, although I never met him, and Isaiah Berlin, who I did. Someone else I met who we've discussed, actually, in the past, is Bishop Richard Williamson, who broke away from the, or was kicked out of the SSPX itself, already a sort of pretty right-wing Catholic breakaway. And I found him so interesting that, you know, and again, I don't think I agree with him on almost anything, but I found him such an intriguing character and one of these sort of people with very, very firm opinions. I wrote him and I said, I'd like to come and see you. So I went to Broadstairs for tea about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years before he died. And I said to him, because he'd often talked about politics and his ideal of politics. And I think this is the sort of politics you're talking about. It. His ideal of politics was down at the level of the village, the priest and the policeman keep order. And it goes all the way to the top. And the whole society is the church. The church doesn't run things. And then there's the secular authorities. But the secular authorities are constantly looking to the church for guidance on what can get published. And I said to him, well, what is your ideal? Would it be Franco? And he said, no, Salazar. So the Portuguese dictator. So that is what he would like. That was his ideal, his idea and his ideal of a sort of perfect Catholic polity. And like you, you know, I'd have been among the Marxist rebels against such a thing.
That's interesting that he said Salazar, because if you think about what happened with Portugal, you have a military takeover, and then the guy that takes over, I can't remember his name, he finds it far too much hard work. So he turns to his friend, who's a professor of law and is very clever, and says, I can't deal with this shit. Can you please be the dictator of the country for the next 30 years or whatever it was. And that's exactly what happened. And so he, an intellectual dictator. But yeah, I mean, Bishop Williamson, I had him on the show years ago.
I saw your interview.
Yeah, I had. He was very good. My internet went down for half an hour, and he just preached to my audience for half an hour. And I came back, and there was like 1,000 people in rapture. And
that must be a rare event on this channel, Ed.
Oh well, indeed. Well, I don't know, but they. And then I had dinner with him. And interestingly, in real life, like IRL, as the kids say, he was far more nervous than when doing a sermon or being interviewed on here. He was far more nervous. But
Ed, can I ask a quick question? Do you think that Andy Burnham, because he's not shy at... I've mentioned this before, he's not shy at promoting the fact he's a Catholic and all his values are informed by Catholicism, until anyone mentions abortion. It will be interesting if, with this clampdown on free speech that's going to be imminent, obviously, whether he draws upon the ignoble history of the Torquemada, the Inquisition.
Well, yeah, I mean, we know the real what the Inquisition were doing.
Exactly. Really. The Inquisition wasn't that bad. And there were several.
It's quite bad.
They didn't execute as many people as people think.
Being taught about the Inquisition is nonsense.
Isn't it?
The Inquisition, I was taught by a medievalist when I was studying at Glasgow, and I had to read a number of primary sources. And interestingly, the Inquisition followed due process. Many of the perceived offenders, they were investigated and interrogated before the case was adjudicated.
Yeah.
Well, it's very reassuring that if he does follow Torquemada, it will be due process. And that would be a nice sort of continuation of the current regime, of the regime that's just passed, you know, between Burnham and his predecessor, whose name I've already forgotten. What was the last Prime Minister's name?
Keir Starmer.
That at least if we get a sort of Catholic Inquisition style hope not hate regime, it will follow due process. That will be extremely
important. His Inquisition will not follow due process. I get what Paul was saying earlier. You will follow the Chinese Inquisition.
Yeah, it'll be a struggle session. That's what I want.
Struggle session.
Now, that's an idea.
We've already seen a struggle session with Gary Lineker. Thank you very much.
There should be mandatory snuggle sessions with Sydney Sweeney. I'd commit loads of crimes.
Did you watch that film I told you to watch, Paul?
No, I'm saving it.
The maid, the something maid, the nurse maid, the whatever it was called, the housemaid. That was what it was called. Yes, but no, I don't. Going back to what the topic I was focusing on, I'm not. If they genuinely think hope not hate that actually our hit pieces on people, including myself, are dangerous, and that they can cause nutcases to take people out, and they think this is a bad thing, then they would take them all down. But they don't do that. They instead take down the one that it could be argued might have inspired or might have contributed to an atmosphere that inspired this. And apparently they're saying he had like clippings of Nigel Farage on his wall and things like this, you know, to chuck darts out or something, I don't know. And so they just take it down as, what's the term, sort of management of the current problem, so that it's not there when you Google it. Absolutely cowardly.
The fat bastard who killed Anne Widdecombe was charged. I just saw it. He was charged, and yes, he is a fat bastard, and I want him to get the death penalty.
Well, if they do give him the death penalty, then you'd have to hang him on a very short rope, because if he's a fat bastard and you hang him on a long rope, his head would come clean off. That's why you have to. That's why Albert Pierpoint had variable rope lengths based on people's weight.
Well, I must admit, I have a great deal of sympathy with those who call for the return of the death penalty. But I had no idea when I came on here that I was going to be exposed to fat phobia. I'm afraid
I hate him. I dislike that person. I cursed his mother's womb.
I think that the Kerry family are under a certain degree of pressure at the moment. Of course, I knew what the names were last week, but the chap that we had on last week advised me, Adam Perkins, advised me that I should not state his name. I don't know who's decided that suddenly it's okay.
Has he been charged now?
And now, just sorry that he has been charged with her murder.
Yeah, but he it's an atmosphere where you're saying that you, those who disagree, as we go back to what Paul was saying, that those who disagree with you are evil. And then if you're a nutcase and you haven't and you haven't done much with your life and you
exactly you're a fat bastard
and you're a bit sad, you're a bit sad and you eat a lot of pies, then you can deal with this and you can claw some self-esteem back by killing some important person and saying, oh, well, look, that's what I've done. That's my contribution to the fight for goodness. And that's a pretty dangerous situation in a society which is, it's not South Africa. I mean, we don't live in houses that are like Fort Knox.
Unfortunately, the UK is not South Africa. So British people, they're sophisticated. They're not going to beat him. That's the problem.
Oh, very quickly, Lipton, have you seen the footage of in South Africa they're having race riots against immigration?
I've seen the clippings. I have not seen the footage, but yeah. I wrote an article on the matter and it will be published soon. It can be explained in terms of developmental psychology. South Africans are not at the formal operational stage of development as yet. That's why they're behaving like that.
Well, also, there's just lots of big genetic ethnic cleavages. I mean, there's massive ethnic cleavages within South Africa, aren't there? So they will see people that are from South Africa, from not South Africa, as even more foreign than they see other tribes within South Africa.
Don't mention massive cleavages because Lipton gets transphobic again, fatphobic.
But that's true, though, isn't it? I mean, like the Khoisa are genetically 50% Bushman and 50%, like something like 60% Bushman and 40% Black. And the Zulu are purely Bantu, and they hate each other, and then you have all these different races that basically hate each other within South Africa, and then these people aren't even that. You know, these people are from Mozambique or
Malawi, Nigeria, Ghana,
anywhere, right? And so they're genetically different, and so you're going to get conflict. But it's by the by. This guy had communist literature in his house. This guy was inspired by these people, and they are now in government. It's quite appalling.
And I think, you know, again, we have to kind of see this from a historical perspective. We've got to the position. We've had both a Labour and a Tory MP killed. My former MP, who was a Tory, felt he had to leave because his constituency office was burnt down and he felt personally threatened. And I, again, dropping another name, I've met Nigel Farage a few times in various circumstances, and I know that he is extremely concerned, rightly so, for his personal safety, to the extent he can't travel on the tube, for example. Now, Clement Attlee used to get the tube back to Stamford every night. I don't know why he wasn't living in Downing Street, perhaps when he was in opposition. But, I mean, this sort of thing wouldn't have occurred to any of us. Well, in the 40s and 50s, of course, in the 70s, there was the threat of the IRA. But basically, the idea of people attacking politicians physically for their opinions, I mean, this is quite novel in this country and extremely alarming.
Well, I suppose it has happened before, but at times of instability. For example, there was Emily Davison, the one that killed herself by going under the King's horse at the Derby. She went up to a guy at Aberdeen railway station that looked like David Lloyd George and attacked him with a whip simply because he looked like David Lloyd George. And she also tried to bomb David Lloyd George's house. So maybe we're just returning to an earlier period of
maybe the mid-20th century was a period of extraordinary civil peace.
It was atypical, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that people are talking about a lot at the moment is that we're on our seventh prime, or Britain is on its seventh prime minister in 10 years, as though this is extraordinary. And it is extraordinary if you start, like, if you're born like me in 1980 and there's a new prime minister every sort of 10 years or something like that. If you go back to the 20s, it was exactly the same thing. You had something like seven, not different people, but changes in prime minister across a period like that. And also in the 1830s and 40s, similar kind of thing. And it was a time of instability and great change. So we're returning to that.
It is a smart man, Dr. Moreland, He's really smart. Paul is also smart. But for smart people, they're quite naive. And let me tell you why I'm saying so. They're naive because the left is revolutionary. The ethics of leftists has always been revolutionary. The abolitionist movement was a radical movement. John Brown was a lunatic. And people seem to forget that left-wingers, they have a long history of being violent. The feminists, they were also violent people. So left-wing violence is not new. It plummeted for a while, and now it's increasing again. So it's just reverting back to what it once was. So I'm not naive at all.
No, I'm not. I mean, I think it fits with that theory that's been propounded on this channel by Jani Mirtanen, that we go through cycles of hormones across four generations, like reindeer do. And we do that in order to outpace our predators and our prey. And so we go through cycles of oxytocin, testosterone, whatever else.
That's really coincidental because I haven't had my dinner yet, and I've had a craving for lichen for about the last hour.
Yeah, you could be silly about it, but we're very closely related genetically to reindeer, so there's no reason why it wouldn't function in the same way. And so
you are.
You've had a desire.
Maybe I'm more closely related to lichen, actually.
To stand in the middle of the road when a car hurtles towards you and just not move. When a stick breaks and you'll run a mile. Yeah, it's fascinating. People render.
Do you think we've got the data to... I mean, that sounds a really interesting theory, a sort of four-generational hormonal cycle. But have we got the data?
Oh, Paul, can I just clarify for you? Ed is a card-carrying crass Darwinist, and I made him a symbol of his crass Darwinism, didn't I, Ed? Have you still got it?
Yeah, it's on the wall over there.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah. David Starkey, when I interviewed on my channel, Paul, he called me. He said this is just crass Darwinism.
He was being
illogical.
Crass Darwinism is real, and we have the evidence for some elements of crass Darwinism, especially when we talk about IQ. Even in Germany, the better quality people were having children.
Is your theory of reindeer grass Darwinism, Ed?
That's very good. That's very good. But that only works if you're northern and you pronounce the word grass wrong.
Right.
No, he silly old queen that he is. He got very upset with this idea. But I think it's this guy Jani Mirtanen, his name is, has presented a lot of evidence for it. In terms of all kinds of proxies for these.
You've probably got the data for animals, right? Who have much shorter lifespans.
Yeah, exactly. And you can see the same thing that they expand, their gene pool, gene flow increases, whatever. So that's a good thing. And then they contract. And this parallels changes in physical size, changes in behavior patterns, changes in how many children they have.
When you say they contract, you mean their numbers contract? They have a kind of hourglass.
Exactly.
This is a form of demography. This is where demography meets research psychology, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So they expand, and then they're too big for the ecology. There's too many of them, and so then Darwinian inclusion hits in, and there has to be a collapse.
I mean, that's a kind of crass Malthusianism, actually. And Darwin was extremely influenced by Malthus. I mean, it's said that when he was on the Beagle and he had this light bulb moment, he said, I was reading Malthus. Mm. Because he had the idea that if human beings kind of live up to some subsistence frontier and exist at the edge of it, and therefore are constantly dying off and some are living and some are dying, then those are the same conditions that animals live in. And if animals live in those conditions, then those conditions will determine which genes are successful and which aren't. He wouldn't have talked in genetic terms, obviously. So Malthus was really a massive influence on Darwin. So we could say it's crass Malthusianism, actually.
Okay,
just because I want to talk about demography.
Yeah, no, but I think so the idea is, and it parallels this book called Fourth Turning by Strauss and Howe. And they note that that every four generations, basically, there's a massive bloody big war and an economic collapse. And we are due a massive bloody big war and an economic collapse.
Wasn't it Giambattista Vico? He was an influence on Spengler and he's an influence on James Joyce. He had this theory of much longer term cycles.
Yes, he did. Yes. It's perfectly possible for there to be sort of micro cycles within longer term cycles. But yeah, that's just the cycle of civilization, that the civilization builds up and then it becomes sort of decadent and unhealthy and whatever, and then it collapses.
And he was very much rediscovered by Isaiah Berlin, actually.
He was, and I have read Isaiah Berlin's essay on Vico, which is in a book of Isaiah Berlin essays that my mum bought me for Christmas in 1998.
Paul, the last time I saw this much shoehorning, I was in Clark's shoe shop.
Clark's themselves being Quakers, and Quakers, of course, being...
Oh, they're the fount of all evil, as far as you're concerned.
The fount of all evil that try to undermine civilization, and to thus relating them to Vico's theory, really, because then you get these decadent people, these Quakers, and they try and bring down civilization. It's all interconnected, people. Wow, we're really getting places intellectually today.
We're joining the dots.
I have one article. It's on conspiracies, and for some strange reason, I have not submitted it to any publication as yet.
I thought you were going to say Lipton had been taken down, and you don't know how.
No.
That would have been very apposite.
Conspiracies are flawed because what we consider to be a conspiracy is really a feature of the system rather than a bug. So wokeism, for example, can be explained in terms of spontaneous order. We didn't need any conspiracy theorist or the WEF or any left-wing feminist professor to make us woke. Over time, there was a selection for the traits we now consider to be woke. So it's a feature of the system rather than a bug.
Well, I think Ed thinks it's a feature of, and I mean, this is a sort of simplification of your crass Darwinism, right? But it's a feature of the fact that, sort of again, thinking about demography, in the past, you had 6 or 7 kids and 2 might survive through. And although those 2 might be the best or the worst, in the round, when so many people were not getting through, so many people were being born but not getting through, nature had a kind of filter which broadly and crudely and crassly sorted out a lot of problems. And now we, in a good, if you're lucky, you have 2. So the population stabilizes, we have fewer, in fact. And therefore, you're not having that filter applying. Get 3 or 4 generations of that, and all sorts of bugs come into the system. I mean, I think that's your theory, isn't it, Ed?
Yeah, Paul, are you advocating crasser Darwinism? It's a schism from Ed's theory.
I'm not even saying I agree with it. I don't know enough about the biology.
Yes, that is basically true. That's correct. Yeah. And so then you get a build-up of what was selected against under the harsh Darwinian conditions, and that's kind of individualistic trait, being individually oriented, being mentally ill, and those things are associated with being left-wing. So you just get more left-wing people.
But I think Lipton's going to have to meet his Thai lady.
Yeah, he has. Yeah.
No, I'm
Lipton comes
they,
and goes.
The theory is they then take over the culture and push you along a maladaptive roadmap of life, and only the genetically, and bring down civilization, and only the genetically conservative and healthy, essentially, survive it. Anyway, we're about halfway through, so those of you who are new, hello. Welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are on my public house, meets on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, which we discuss based science and stuff in the ongoing collapse of civilization, and interesting research that's increasingly expunged from our woke joke universities. If you are new, will you please subscribe? You subscribe on here on YouTube and leave a like and click the bell button and leave a comment and all that malarkey. And when you subscribe to my Substack, that's johnnyherrick.com, where I put all the most base stuff I don't put on YouTube, in-person interviews, vlogs, films I make, my new film about Moldova, for example, where there is you can get a month free subscription or something if you go and have a look. Where if you like what I do, you support me the cost of around a pint of beer a month, and all my books, of course, are all available on Amazon. And we've referenced today Woke Eugenics and my biography of Jonathan Bowden. That's the Shame of the Radical Right, and various others. Okay, now next to me we have Dr. Paul Taylor, and he's written various expensive books about that guy with the Slovenian guy with the lisp. I can't
Slavoj Žižek.
Yep, that. And he used to be.
What if the opposite is true?
Exactly, and he used to be the editor of the Slavoj Žižek Studies journal. So go over there and buy his books, and then, of course...
And I've met him, Paul.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I spent a weekend with him, actually. Not in the biblical sense, but it was very funny.
Was it nice?
He told there was an old rickety train on the way to Liverpool. We went from Manchester to Liverpool, and I don't know whether they've changed them, but the trains were awful and they were dead noisy. So you had a whole carriage full of Scousers. And he told me a sexually deviant and absolutely filthy true story about Alain Badiou, who was a French philosopher. And the punchline was, and the whole carriage were on their phone initially. And then one by one, the phones got put down as he was screeching and lisping. And the punchline was, he shouted out in the loudest voice, and he didn't use lubrication. And I was thinking, oh my God, how am I going to get through this journey? He was mad as a box of frogs. Very funny, though.
Okay, well, so go and subscribe there. Sorry, to Paul's channel, I'm sorry, which is called Readers of the Lost Art, which takes a sort of grumpy and misanthropic look at scouse look at literature of various kinds. Do you have anything you want to plug about that, Paul?
I've just done something on the Odyssey film and how abysmal it is.
Yes, I myself will be doing a video tomorrow on the Odyssey film and how abysmal it is. Okay, so
copycat.
I thought of it before. I didn't like. I honestly
prevaricating copycat.
No, I watched it earlier.
He's calling me a liar.
On 1, 2, 3 movies that have been filmed in a French cinema, and I watched it. It took 3 hours. 3 hours long, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, but you see, my secret was I haven't seen it yet.
So you're just going to condemn it.
Well, no, I talked about general plot devices and how they've adapted, because I know this factually, how they've adapted Homer's original. So I'm not talking about the actual film itself. I couldn't care less. I've seen enough Hollywood in my life. I'm talking about what factually he's done. And the fact, the unrealism of the whole thing, like you'd go back to Anne Hathaway if you're stuck on an island with Charlize Theron. Of course you wouldn't go home.
Yeah, that bird that stuck him on the Lotus Eaters Island, she was really fit.
Charlize Theron.
Right, so that didn't make any sense to
no,
me at all.
Anne Hathaway, really, plain Jane. You wouldn't go back to Anne.
It was really, exactly. It's like that 1990s comedy, Goodnight Sweetheart. And in the, I don't know, the third series, they changed both the actresses, the actress that played his wife and the actress that played Phoebe. And in the third series, the actress that played his wife was way fitter than the actress that played Phoebe. In the earlier series, Phoebe was played by that Irish piece, I don't know what her name was, Dervla Kerwin. And there was some rough bird that played his wife, so you can see how that worked. But in the later series, his wife is made a peer of the realm, and she's really fit. And he's going back to some ugly barmaid in the east end of London in 1942. It's insane. Anyway, good. Then we have Lipton Matthews, who's appearing and disappearing, but there he is. And so he's subscribed to his channel. That's Lipton Matthews, and the new channel we're doing, of course, the Lipton.
I got a book review. It's in American Spectator by Lawrence Mead.
About Lawrence? You wrote
Lawrence that. Mead wrote a review of my book in the American Spectator.
Oh, good, good. Well, so go and read. I think I've interviewed Lawrence Mead on this channel.
Of course you have.
Yeah, the name's familiar. So go and read Lipson's new book, which is called what?
Busting African Delusions.
But yeah, go and read Lipton's new book, Busting African Delusions. And then finally, we have a Docs Paul Moreland. And I don't think he has a YouTube channel, do you, Paul?
No, I do lots of stuff that ends up on YouTube. So if you put my name into YouTube, you'll end up with all sorts of weird and wonderful interviews I've done. Yes.
Yes, and Paul's new book, which is coming out soon.
Bust, The Economics of Population Decline with Philip Pilkington.
Okay, and I'm going to interview him about that at some point.
Would be a good name for the autobiography of Sidney Sweeney.
We're going to start talking about cleavages again, aren't we?
We're going to go on to Andy Burnham and that discussion, but yeah, cleavages. But anyway, so Paul, Bust, tomorrow's people, no one left. The something tide.
The human tide.
What? Philip Pilkington. I know Philip, not personally, but I'm familiar with his work.
Well done.
Isn't there a comedian called Pilkington? Carl Pilkington.
Not that I know. There's a gloss.
Is there Carl Pilkington? Or have I made that up?
Yeah, rings a vague bell.
I wonder if he's his brother. But anyway,
he's probably not. Yeah.
So go and buy all those books, okay? All those books. Okay, now we have a resident poet here at the Jolly Heretic Public House, Mr. Quinn, and he's written the following poem with regard to what we were discussing tonight. He says, "Greetings from Sardinia, tonight's poem. I don't want to sound too bombastic. Was Widdicombe's killing stochastic? It's posh speak for random, but hope not hates fandom would surely do nothing this drastic." Thank you much, Mr. Quinn.
That's very good, actually. Yeah,
no, he does. He writes one every week. So thank you much, Mr. Quinn. And if you like Mr. Quinn's poetry, which you should, then please subscribe to his channel. That's Resident Poet at the Jolly Heretic. And go over to Amazon, where you can buy his book of Jolly Heretic poetry. Okay, we have a question, a super chat, which has been sent in by Right Wing Chick. No, Right Chicken Wing. And it says, I don't know how to sort of scroll this down. I'm totally looking at booking a holiday in Moldova, Ed. Thank you for your documentary. I wonder if the Moldovans will appreciate the added tourism. Yes, they will. I was in a taxi and the guy apparently said in Romanian to my translator that he felt it was an honour to have an English person in his taxi because they think England's all like Monty Python and stuff like that. So yeah, go over to Moldova. There'll be almost no other tourists, and it's an interesting place, and it's worth.
I am actually 1/8 Romanian, I should declare.
Are you?
I am.
Actual Romanian or like Jewish Romanian?
Well, Jewish and not even Romanian, because where my great grandmother came from, whilst it was in Romania when she was born there, is now in Ukraine, I'm afraid. But I still have a strong ethnic identification as a Romanian.
Well, that's excellent. Well, cheers.
Even one of my books was translated into Romanian.
That's a weird thing that happened to me. Someone got in touch and they wanted to translate loads of my books into Romanian, but then the publisher seemed to collapse and it never actually happened. I've been translated into Bulgarian.
No, that I haven't been yet.
Which neighbours Romania.
I've been translated into Chinese.
Translated into Estonian, which is strange because it's such a small group. You'd think who's... Anyway, wait, you can probably read it, Ed.
Chinese is quite good.
I've been translated into Japanese, and a Chinese woman got in touch and wanted to translate my book into Chinese, but I'm not aware that it ever happened, but Japanese. You said they send you a free copy. And it looks really pretty, but it's completely meaningless. I mean, I can't...
Oh, I have a bookshelf with all the foreign editions of my books.
No, I gave my Japanese one away as a birthday present to a Japanese girl. Because I just
Japanese books are very beautiful. I mean, it was beautifully produced.
Is this part of a seduction strategy, Ed?
No. It was just her birthday party, and I completely forgotten that I should buy her a present. And I realized I had my book in Japanese, so I just gave it to her. So
the relationship never went anywhere after that, I'm assuming.
No, she loved it.
That suggests you read it.
No, she thought it was great. She thought it was great.
They're very polite people, Ed. Don't believe the hype.
Well, it was very pretty though. Paul's right. It had like a little bookmarking ribbon in it, and it was all very, very lovely. And Russian. I've had a book translated into Russian. Okay, now I was going to say, chaps, bit of news for you. Jim Goad. I know a lot of you here that are watching will be a fan of Jim Goad. Jim Goad has died. He died on the 22nd of June. He was 65 years old. And we don't know the reason yet, but it's very, very sad. He actually sent me two of his books to review. Here's one of them, Whiteness, the Original Sin. And I recommend it. It's very funny. And this is another one that he sent me called Answer Me at Hardback. I don't know. But there you are. So I thought I interviewed him on the channel some years ago. He was a very nice guy.
Yes.
And I know that he had a sort of difficult upbringing, and he said his mum was beaten up by his dad while she was pregnant with him, and there were various consequent health problems. But anyway, now unfortunately he's passed away. That is the fourth person that has been on the Jolly Heretic that has then died.
Are you going to turn it into a weekly event? We can.
No, I hope not. I hope.
Paul is looking quite peaky, I must say.
I'm 61, so.
But you're looking peaky.
Paul will be alive and kicking this time next week. But no, we've had the Z-Man.
As long as I don't get a page on Hope Not Hate.
Well,
Lipton fades in and out of good health, so I'm worried about him as well.
He fades in and out of existence, it would appear.
The Z-Man, Richard Lynn, the Bishop that we talked about earlier, Bishop Williamson, and now
Jamie never had Bowden on. I mean, he had a very untimely death, didn't he?
Yes, 49 years old.
49,
blimey. I mean, that's nothing, is it, really? I mean,
what did he die of?
Heart attack.
Who died of heart attack at 49? Jonathan Bowden?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So that's a shame. Okay, good. Now moving on then to the issue of the new Stalin, Mr. Andy Burnham. I haven't checked for the last hour because we've been on for an hour what's been going on. This is the biggest cull of cabinet ministers, as far as I can work out, in one go since 1962.
Did someone say they've got rid of Lammy? I can't believe how the country will survive without him.
How, indeed, how will it survive without...
I think when you have someone of such staggering intellect in politics, not to have them on the front row seems the most dreadful waste, doesn't it?
If ever I very rarely feel depressed, but if I ever was, I just watch his Mastermind performance on a loop.
I just love the idea that he thinks that Henry VII came after Henry VIII. I mean, it's brilliant. It's just brilliant stuff.
Well, the better one was who invented, what was it? He confused Marie Antoinette with Marie Curie.
Well, they...
Maybe they should have a vacuum in his head.
They did both... well, anyway, look, I don't know. Obviously, it's brilliant that he didn't just offer, as I understand it, he didn't do things like offer them humiliating jobs that they had to refuse, which he did do with Rachel Reeves. He just sacked them.
I mentioned Attlee already. It reminds me of Attlee. Apparently, some cabinet minister, maybe you know this, came to him and said, "What have I done to deserve my sacking?" To which he said, "Not up to the job. Good day."
What are they going to call it? The Night of the Long Cliches.
The Night of the Long Toffees.
I mean, I think the most alarming thing about Burnham, actually, is what he said about the bond markets. And I thought there's a very simple analogy. Someone who has a large overdraft, which he is still running up at fantastic speed, and therefore his lifestyle, his daily expenditure depends on the goodwill of his bank manager, to which he says, "Oh, I'm not going to let the bank manager tell me what to do. We mustn't let the bank manager." I mean, that's fine if he's got a plan not to rely on the bank manager expanding his overdraft. And that's exactly what a man like Burnham is doing when he says, "Oh, we don't need to worry about the bond markets too much," although he expects to borrow from them trillions, billions, goodness knows how much, over the next, for his 10-year plan, supposedly.
Yes, I don't really understand all of this, so I'm going to defer to Paul and Lipton and other Paul with regard to this. So what he's saying he wants to do is take the country, is that there's been a lot of mistakes over the last 40 years, and basically they should be reversed. And it strikes me that if the Thatcher revolution hadn't happened, then, as Thatcher herself said, what the left would prefer is that the poor were poorer as long as the rich were less rich.
Well, Ed, there's an even more funny practical issue. The vast majority of the Labour cabinet all grew up and made their early careers in education under Thatcherism. So they're moaning about all the harm Thatcher did, and they got up the greasy pole in her regime.
Or as a consequence of her policies. Yeah. And Blairism has been argued to basically be the successor of Thatcherism, but with, you know, proto-woke chucked in. I mean, he brought in things that Thatcher would never have dared to have brought in, but would, I'm sure, would have loved to, such as university tuition fees, and which I think were a terrible, terrible mistake. But it does seem to me, if he's saying that he wants to go back to the 1970s, this means that you have trade unions that are powerful. This means that you can't do, you have a command economy. You're going to have heavy inflation it sounds to me, I wasn't around then, Paul and Paul were. I mean, tell me what you think, either of you. This sounds to me very bad. It sounds to me like just making it worse than it already is.
Well, I think on the one hand, it is very bad, because those of us who do remember the 70s, and there are criticisms of Thatcher now, and I think there are reasons to be critical. And any historical analysis or write-up biography of someone, there should be, it's not hagiography, it's biography. But the country was in an absolutely appalling way in the 70s. And what she did in a whole number of ways, by taking a huge amount of the economy out of the control of Beitel and putting it into the private sector, by standing up with Reagan to the Soviet Union, by standing up to the trade unions, particularly the miners' strike, all created a world which New Labour could then come in and effectively, I think they trashed it, but they could benefit from it and sit prettily in power, taking advantage of it. So on the one hand, I think his talk about reversing this is extremely alarming. On the other hand, I think he is so vacuous that he really doesn't have an idea. I don't think he has a clue. I think there are fundamental problems in the country. The politicians won't deal with them, won't address them. And so we have this succession of ever more clown-like characters bleating ever more vacuous and meaningless statements. I mean, that's the best I can give you on.
Well, I honestly...
That's the highest stage of this, to sort of polarize Lenin.
I honestly think that he's going to be less popular in short order than two-tier Keir. Because whatever you say about Keir Starmer, he had some sort of democratic mandate. He won an election. And if you play by the rules, he won the election. He had a manifesto. You have to let him do the harm he's going to do. Burnham doesn't even have that. Amidst the empty cliches is a complete lack of a mandate.
It's worse than that. I don't know when there was last this degree of a lack of a mandate. Because he actually said in an interview with Beth Rigby today on Sky, look, we're in a parliamentary system and you can be prime minister as long as you can command more than half of the support of more than half of the MPs, which is insane, because Labour were themselves saying when Liz Truss was elected, when Boris was first elected before he won an election, and when Rishi was elected. This is outrageous, this is appalling, there should be an election. So the hypocrisy is ridiculous, but I understand that. But it's worse than that. I don't know when it was, like with Gordon Brown, he became Prime Minister, but he'd been a senior figure in the government of Tony Blair, who'd won an election in 2005. Or when John Major became Prime Minister, he'd at least been a cabinet minister. I don't know exactly what rank, I forget what it might have been, employment minister or something. When Mrs. Thatcher won the election.
I think he'd been Chancellor, actually.
No, but that was later. That was later. When 87 election happened,
right,
he was some more junior minister or more junior cabinet minister. But and then he became Foreign Secretary and then he became Chancellor. That's right. I don't know when it was, like, even Churchill. When Neville Chamberlain took power, he wasn't in the cabinet or whatever, but he was at least in parliament and he'd stood as a conservative. This guy hasn't been in parliament for 10 years. He wasn't elected. He didn't stand on the manifesto of the British people supposedly voted for. He wasn't even there. He was busy being mayor of Manchester. So I can't think of anything like it. At all, except possibly a peer of the realm being randomly appointed prime minister at some point in the past. Of course, then they don't have to stand for election.
And I've said it before, I'll say it again, if Crackadilly Gardens in Manchester is anything to go by while he was mayor, the country is in for a hell of a shock.
Yeah, he's actually said that. He said that his key policy is to end rough sleeping. So
yeah, we'll start. Take the plank out your own eye before you take the splinter out of somebody else's.
So basically, we can show what a crap prime minister he is and how he can't keep to his pledges by just spending one night sleeping on Wimbledon Common in a tent. Like that'll show him. Like we should all get some tents.
For a man with his eyelashes, that'd be very dangerous.
And pitch them. You know, I think Wimbledon Common, like the episode of Bottom. And just stay the night there. And that'll show.
I think, Ed, you've pitched a few tents on Wimbledon Common, I guess.
No, I haven't. I've never actually pitched a tent. I've watched my father do so in Dorset in the 80s. But I've never pitched a tent.
You have a very
hamster teeth more convenient. Is that allowed?
Sorry?
Well, I said I'd find hamster teeth more convenient. Is that allowed?
We defer to your experience, Paul.
There may be hazards.
But that's the thing. You don't even have to have the intelligence these days to pitch a tent. You can just buy those tents that just are sort of self-raising, like self-raising flowers.
But are you sure you've never pitched a tent, Ed?
I have never pitched a tent.
I want that on the record for all your listeners.
On the record, I've stayed in tents such as at the Cambridge Folk Festival in 2003, but I've never actually put up the tent myself.
And you've
I went on a camping holiday in Mali once.
In Mali?
Mali. Really?
Well, I suppose it's hot. I mean, you can cope with that.
This is killing me, the suspense. You've never heard of the colloquial expression, pitching a tent.
I assume it means an erection. Does it mean an erection?
Well, we got there in the end.
Because this is a family show, Paul. We know that there's people watching with their children.
They'll be reported to social services.
And yeah, new Prime Minister Andy apparently is interested in North Sea oil. So if he's serious about energizing the UK with fossil fuels and oil, then I can tolerate him.
Well, that's good.
What's he going to do with Ed Miliband?
I don't know. Maybe he should retire.
Someone check. Lipton, can you check? So we've got a super chat, by the way, from somebody called Right Chicken Wing. We've done that one. Sorry, from somebody else. Toddy Terrence, yes. Hello, sir. Hope Not Hate facilitated the crime with propaganda with a far-right list of people they mention or report on or blog. Months ago, yes, I agree with you. As we discussed earlier, as Paul Morland was saying, being right wing, being conservative, we tend to give them the benefit of the doubt and just think that they're poor, misled souls that forgive them, Lord, but they don't know what they do. But no, I don't agree with that. I think that they deliberately did it. I think that they knew that they hoped that if they wrote stuff like this, then some nutcase would otherwise. What's the point of doing it? Like, what is the point of writing all these inflammatory things about people?
To shame and marginalise, but not necessarily to...
If you shame and marginalise them, then what you are saying to a certain kind of mind is this person is beyond the pale, this person is bad, this person indeed is wicked, this person is like Hitler. So this person's a Nazi. So you know that there's going to be some people that are going to react to that by saying, OK, this person's evil and I might, I should at the very least beat them up. In order to paper over the cracks in their identity and make themselves feel better about themselves. They know that's an element of what they're doing.
Anyway, we should get back to Burnham, shouldn't we? Lipton thinks it will be forgivable at the North Sea.
Yeah, I'm not saying that I'm a fan, but I love all British politicians. They're all wonderful people, every single one of them. Even Sir Keir Starmer. Every single one of them are lovely people.
Are you taking the citizenship test soon, Lipton? Is that what's going on?
I don't know yet, but I love all British politicians. You know, personally, I think it should be easy for all of us to migrate. So if you live in Japan, and Japan's a bad example because it's a high status country, but if you live somewhere in Ghana and you want to live in the UK, it should be easy to relocate to the UK. But there is one condition. You're on your own. So no welfare. You can't file for asylum. You can't select your refugee. If you're broke or you can't get a job, you're just on your own. And if we do that, then they will deport themselves. When Europeans migrated to America in the 19th century, some of them returned home back to Europe if they weren't making enough money in America. People are coming here for welfare. So if they come here and they have no option but to work, they will return home.
You know, a good entrance test. I think people should be forced to watch Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer, and if they don't laugh, they're not allowed to enter. Because I think it is the most British humour you could ever imagine.
I think that you should. A woman I know, she only likes English men, and she wants to test their Englishness. She carries 4 candles in her handbag, and then she gets them out and puts them on the table. And if they don't understand the reference, then it's out.
That suggests she likes men of a certain age, actually.
Yeah, probably it does. Yeah, borderlines tend to like much older men. So yeah, that's true. But they should at least understand the reference. But no, going back to Andy Burnham, one of the things that struck me is there's absolutely no policies at all. Right? Tony Blair, he was very good with words and all this and making feel, you know, what is important is that we do all this.
I feel the hand of
education,
history
education,
on my shoulder.
Education.
Now it's not time for cliches. We can sound bites. We can leave those at home, but I do feel the hand of history on my shoulder. I mean, it was brilliant. I mean, it was perfect. But at least there were clear policies. We are going to mess around with the House of Lords. We are going to restrict free speech. We are going to, destroy the country. There were clear policies. Burnham has said absolutely nothing. It's worse than Keir Starmer, as Paul said to me before the show, Paul Taylor. It's just word salad. It's just you know, we're going to make Britain more united and less not united. And, we're going to, we've not been good enough and we're going to do better. And it's just nothing.
Mind you, can I remind you of another prime minister who came into number 10 with cliches? Where there is discord, let us bring harmony.
Winston Churchill.
That was Margaret Thatcher,
right? I saw that was better than
But I never believed it for a moment. And fortunately, she had no intention of bringing harmony where there was discord. What we needed was lots of discord where there was faux harmony.
Personally, I think Ed should become the next prime minister.
I know, but unfortunately, I'm not a member of parliament.
But Ed is what I would call the weak-willed white man. He has no Promethean spirit whatsoever, no ambition. Ed is not a man of action. You're not a man of action, Ed.
So why do you want him as prime minister then?
When Ed becomes the prime... Ed is really charismatic. I don't think I'm that charismatic. When Ed becomes the prime minister, I can use him to push my real right-wing agenda. The 19th Amendment is going home.
Yeah, that is the relationship between me and Lipton. I'm like Leonardo DiCaprio in that film.
Yes,
and he kind of tells me what to do.
The colonies were taking them back. I'm sorry, but India, you're coming back.
And that's I don't know if I it would be a lot of effort to administer India. I've been to India. It's chaos. I don't feel that it would be worth our while.
Interest, but you get the point. The Empire is coming back. Pax Britannica is coming back.
I quite like, though, Ed,
the concept of al fresco defecation. I think it's a development that, you know, we could learn from.
Well, with climate change, it's so much more comfortable, isn't it?
Yeah.
Something I mastered while camping in Mali.
I'm sure you did. There were these two blokes, and one of them said, it's nicer, isn't it? And the other one said, yeah, I think I'll get mine out as well. Although, ironically, in those kinds of countries like Mali, you don't need your penis because you just sweat it out. You don't urinate. I didn't urinate when I was in India. It didn't happen. You just sweat it out. So
I'm collecting autobiographical titles for your forthcoming book, Ed, and you don't need your penis. It's coming in about third or fourth at the moment.
With the subtitle, I never pitched a tent.
But anyway, look, seriously, we've moved off topic. So going back to can someone check who is the current chancellor? The current foreign secretary. So the chancellor is a guy called.
Don't they ask you that when you get admitted to a mental hospital?
Who's the prime minister? I think
that's one of the test questions, isn't it?
Who's the prime minister? But he's
we have a chancellery of the exchequer called Healy again, which I think's a marvellous retro 1970s thing for those who've got memories long enough.
Oh, that is really. Oh, he's called Healy. So like,
yeah, he's the former defence secretary.
So Dennis Healy, and now it's John Healy, I believe. Correct. John Healy, who is foreign secretary? Do we know that?
Miliband, someone said in the chat.
I think Ed Miliband's been confirmed. Yeah. Which is great, because that's probably the place he can do the least damage.
Mm. Right. It's common sense, unity, and that's it. There's nothing. He has no
growth,
idea.
Growth,
yeah.
Net zero. Pro business. Wealth taxes. A very consistent, coherent package.
What's happened to Rayner, my mate? Has Rayner got a job, Ed? Do you know?
I don't know. I haven't been. We've been on here for an hour and 16 minutes, and I don't know if Rayner has got a job. But it's
don't say that so defensively.
I'm not sorry. I don't mean. I'm sorry. But they have. He has no ideas, and I get the impression there are very clear problems in the UK that, by the way, we don't really have in Finland to the same extent at all. Very clear problems that the cost of energy is far too high. You have nobody buys shares in the UK compared to in other countries. So to the extent that they have wealth, it's all locked up in property. Old people are more likely to vote, and then old people therefore don't want there to be more property because their property will then not be worth as much, and their main asset is property. So young people are locked out of the system, and they don't tend to vote anyway, so who cares what they say?
And we're not having enough children.
And we're not having enough children, so there's not enough young people. That's
another
problem. That
is very common across the world. That's not just a British problem, but that doesn't make it any less urgent that we fix it in Britain.
But also, presumably, what that means, Paul, is that there is less innovation. Old people don't like change, and the culture of not liking change permeates out across society. So you don't get new ideas, you don't get innovation.
Well, I don't want to get on my soapbox, but briefly, what I talk about is four greys. You have grey labour, i.e. shrinking and ageing workforce, less innovative, less inventive, less likely to set up businesses. You have the grey budget, so the fact that the government spends vastly more on an 80-year-old than a 20-year-old on health and pensions and so on, so you cannot balance a budget with this kind of demography. You have the grey consumer, so people are actually not only producing less new stuff, they are less likely to try it out, less likely to be innovative, more likely to need lots of hands-on care. So just as your labour force is shrinking, you need more labour. And then we have the greying investor who will take less risk with his or her money. So it all leads, you know, aging leads to this is the theme of the next book. Aging leads to a shriveling of society and the economy.
But Paul, what about AI? Couldn't it be said that we're going to have far too many badly educated university graduates because of AI?
Well, I think that education and the sort of scandal that is the average British university education, where it doesn't equip people for doing anything useful, is a huge topic. But I don't fundamentally believe we're going to be short of jobs for people. I think AI will change the workforce. I mean, the example I always give, never mind the Luddites who thought you have to smash the machines because the machines are going to take all the jobs. Then we got a mass industrial working class. There were 300,000 horses in London in 1900, and people were, you know, giving them, people were responsible for looking after them and growing their feed, etc., and driving them. And within sort of 30, 40 years, their number was tiny, but you didn't get a lot of unemployment. I think there's a lot that people need to do, a lot of work that needs doing. A lot of employers, just as we have unemployment among the young, and there's a misallocation, we do have a lot of jobs that people find it very hard to find anyone to do. For, you know, the basic skills, looking after old people, fixing taps. I think we've misallocated our human capital, but I don't think AI is going to replace the need for labour.
Yeah, booked Ed to be wiping my backside in 10 years' time, if not earlier.
I was saying that AI is a
I'm 59.
Studies by MIT and Yale, they have shown that the effects of AI are less than impressive. I think AI is a bubble. And it's producing workplace slop. But that's the latter point is indeed true. That's what studies show. It is producing workplace slop.
Don't insult AI too much. It wrote most of its books.
This is my issue with AI. In the context of declining IQ, we don't have enough people who are smart enough to use average technology. And AI
could you explain that again, please?
What did you say, Paul?
Could you explain that again, please?
Now, I was saying in the context of declining IQ, we don't have enough brilliant people to use average technology. So AI is relatively average technology. But other than people in finance or economists or really good researchers, most people are not using AI to create value or new information.
Are you following that, Ed?
AI create an image of Donald Trump. AI, tell me about my date. They're falling in love with AI. We don't have enough robotics.
Robotics is nowhere near as advanced as AI. That's the thing. Also, what Paul M said is that you still need plumbers and electricians and people like that.
But Ed, have you seen the footage of the robot that starts kung fu kicking the guys who are trying to tame it? There's a YouTube video.
I've seen the footage of the robot that gets his head smashed off and carries on fighting. Is that the one you're talking about?
It might be. But it's like, there's a picture of it doing a kung fu kick, and it looks quite adept.
Yeah, I'm sure but that's not useful, is it? That's not going to help you. That's not going to change.
Well, it shows a certain type of agility.
Yes,
that's true. A set pattern, I think.
Well, bum wiping could be, you know, routinized.
The trouble is, it can't be. I mean, even picking up the bins, apparently, the robotics is nowhere near doing the bins.
Exactly. And as for your bum wiping example, well,
I don't know why I keep going back to it.
It is going to be a huge issue, actually.
The size of my backside, yes.
I mean, like with my grandmother, my mum had to employ a Lithuanian carer to live with her in her house and do things like that.
And the number of Lithuanians is going to fall dramatically. And all the people, you know, Eastern Europe's had a long declining fertility rate. So there just won't be many Poles and Lithuanians and Bulgarians and, I regret to say, Romanians in 20, 30 years' time. And the idea that we're going to always be wealthier than them and we can pay them to come over, there won't be that many of them, and the living standards are narrowing. So we just can't assume someone's going to come and do it for us.
No, exactly. I mean, the Poland will soon, on current trends, be richer than the UK.
Yeah, but there'll be fewer and fewer Poles.
And there'll be fewer and fewer Poles. Yeah, that's true. And we only, I mean, we'd have to cut the population of the UK by what, 10 or 20 million if it wasn't for immigration. So I don't know where we would be if there was a complete, you'd just be in a situation where labour was very, very expensive. It would be like the time after the Black Death.
And therefore labor. A lot of people wouldn't get labour, i.e., you know, a lot of bums would not be wiped.
Yeah, but is that true, given that the unskilled immigrants are a net drain on the economy? Yes, wages would increase, but we're already paying for people who aren't doing anything.
Yeah, I mean,
I've here illegally.
I've written a paper on the trade-off between immigration, with Philip Pilkington, actually, the next book's with, on the trade-off between immigration, fertility, and immigration with economic dynamism and fertility. And basically, immigration is not a long-term fix for the problems of an economy where the fertility rate is too low. Particularly if you're bringing in large numbers of very unskilled people who then bring in large numbers of family members who don't work, yeah, and go on welfare.
And who, guess what? And they all get old.
And they all get old and they don't have a high fertility rate themselves. I mean, I've written on this extensively, the reasons why we should not be relying on other people to do our breeding for us. I know you've got two children, haven't you, Ed? How many have you got, Paul? Have you got any?
I've got a genetic ASBO. I'm not allowed.
I don't have any children yet.
No?
I think Lipton's probably going to end up about 8 or 9.
Woman. I haven't found a white woman as yet.
Lipton, how many kids are you going to have?
Maybe 1 or 2, but I haven't found a white woman as yet.
Yeah, but that's a problem, because that's associated with infertility, isn't it? Because the genes are so different.
Yeah. No, interracial relationships do lead to health problems, but I have white ancestors, so it's okay. We have done enough in interracial breeding, so it's okay.
How many children do you have, Paul?
I've got 3, and my 5th grandchild's on its way.
Wow. I like people. I like academics like Paul. Nobody is studying this topic. The Gilded Age. Some of the men were wealthy during the Gilded Age. They have descendants. Esteemed U.S. politicians, many of them have descendants. Our elite professors, too many of them have no children. So where are we going to get the growth from, if not the grandchildren of the smartest people?
Well, it's interesting you talk of the Gilded Age, because the book after the next one, which I'm working on, Peak Europe, looks at the 1880s and 90s at its demography and says this really was the golden age of Europe. And from then, the demography started to go downhill, and Europe, which at that point was totally dominant in the globe, began its decline on the basis of
what you're basically looking at is dysgenics, then.
Exactly.
Well, I'll have to consult you on the genetic side because I'm really looking just at the numbers and the age groups.
Like Paul Taylor is a major liability. High IQ, no children. Not even one.
That I know of.
Not even, exactly. You need to get one. You can get information
from young girl. He's got some bird preggers at Edinburgh University in the
80s. Exactly.
Down on the Leith docks could be a few little poles running around.
Sure, absolutely.
Just like last week, I was online and I said, I believe I have cracked the code. I know how British companies work. So I created this resume, completely fake resume, fake qualifications, fake jobs, and I sent it to a company expecting to get a reply, and I did, because British companies follow a particular script. And I'm saying this against the backdrop of many British young people graduating from school and they cannot get an interview, not a job, an interview. Why are these people unable to get an interview? Again, low intelligence. They don't understand the market. They live in the country, but they're uninformed. They're naive and they really don't know what they're doing.
So what lies did you tell on this CV, Lipton?
Okay, it's easy. So British companies, Ed, many of them are only employing people who did exactly what they want you to do now, so you should be in a similar job before applying, or they're employing people whose track record is similar to the people who work at the company now. So if one person was a business finance manager and you were a business finance manager, that's a plus. So I've been reading LinkedIn to look at various profiles on LinkedIn, and because of my LinkedIn research, I was able to do a number of hypothetical resumes, and I was successful. In most cases, I was successful. British companies are only employing people who did exactly the same job or people whose pre-employment resume is similar to the individuals who work at the company now. So if you don't take the time to study specific companies, know what they like, it's going to be harder for you to get a job. So it's easy to get the interview if you know how the market works. It's harder to get the job.
I shouldn't say that I have a doctorate in divinity. I shouldn't say that.
No, British employers don't care about your degrees. That's irrelevant. So, for example, you worked at a bank once, so you have banking experience. Your degree in theology is irrelevant. So you could get a job at a bank in administration.
But Lipton, so, that's how we got our ex-chancellor of the Exchequer.
The only time I've been asked to prove my qualifications was when I worked at a university in Latvia. That was the only time I was ever asked to prove I had a PhD.
You could get a job as a holy man, Ed, right? I mean, we're assuming you're looking for a job in the bank. If you're looking for a job as a holy man or a guru, then a degree in divinity might be very useful.
It's true. When I first came to this country and I was unemployed, and they said, well, what qualifications have you got? I said, I've got a doctorate in divinity. They said, okay, well, we will put you on this work scheme where you learn Finnish and you become a Lutheran priest.
Couldn't you have been an Oyla Vule model?
No. To the extent that I had an interview with the Bishop of Oulu, and he decided I was holy enough to become a Lutheran priest, and it went from there.
Oulu anyway, sounds like a dyslexic Oulu.
Oh, I see what you mean. No, Oulu, Oulu.
Oulu.
Yeah, in Swedish, Ulia body. But anyway, we...
Is your divinity degree and the fact that you're married to a priest related to each other, is it?
Well, yeah, I met her. She was an exchange student at Aberdeen University when I was a PhD student. That's how we met. Yeah. And I was doing field work on the evangelical Christian students, and she was one of them. So that's how we met. Okay, so we've come to the end of our 90 minutes. So I would like to thank Dr. Paul Morland for coming on. Remember to buy ahead of time his most recent book, his new book, Bust.
Bust, the Economics of Population Decline. But the one that's out, the most recent one that's out, is No One Left, Why the World Needs More Children.
Yep, give no Bust your support. Buy it.
Yeah, and right. Tomorrow's People, I think, is the best title. And that's a good title. It sounds like Tomorrow's World. a sort of a 1970s sort of horror movie, Tomorrow's People.
I think there was a 70s TV series called Tomorrow's People. Yeah, The Tomorrow People.
Yeah, that sort of was in the back of my mind when I came up with the idea for the title.
Good. So do that. And we will see you all. I can't remember whether I will be here next Monday. I might be on holiday. We're having a family holiday to Auschwitz. So I think I might be there. But anyway, no, 20th to 27th. I'm not sure, but I'll check. All right, anyway, see you soon, chaps, and tally-ho and all that malarkey, and goodbye.
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 Okay, stay on, because it